was so long ago that there are very few. I meet very few people from that period if I go to these reunion dinners.
Uh-huh.
And they're always the same people every time, yeah? So, and they all talk about their doggies. And it's the same stories you hear every time. And it's all very boring. Because many of them went to the Antarctic just once only. And never went back again. They came back, they got married, they became businessmen or bankers or whatever. And I spent my whole life working in the polar regions. It was my career. So they have nothing to say except just the same old things all the time. The same stories.
There are people who went to several times, the Antarctic
club. Yes, 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 in recent years there have been a few like that. Yeah, that's right. But so let's just talk first about how you want to actually do this. I mean, for example, I can give you, so that I don't have to spend a lot of time just telling you who I am, what I've done. I can give you the information about that if that's easier.
That's very good if you do that.
Like, for example, I've got all this stuff here, which tells you what I've done, at least up to 1985. I haven't finished it from 85 on. But this gives you plenty of detail up to that time, and the list of the books and the publications and things like that. I can also give you, this is about my general career. These are the journeys that I've made in the Arctic, and then in the Antarctic I've shown you some on the map. I went on two expeditions to the Antarctic. The first one was for 3 years down to the British Antarctic Survey, spent 3 years there. And I made maps in the peninsula area. Then the second time I went with the New Zealand expedition. And that time I was making maps in the Beardmore Glacier, Queen Maud Range, the ones I showed you just inside. So the sum total of miles that I've traveled with dogs is about 25,000 miles. And most of that has been through unexplored country where nobody has been before or since. And that was my job. That's what I was doing.
You call it a job?
That's my job. That was my profession.
You've been on some journeys where you... how did you choose the place where you went? Did you choose it? Or?
Yeah, it... Most of the journeys that I've made have been to areas where there's been no maps. I was there as a map maker. That was my work, making maps. And so I would go to places where there were no maps. Now, in the Antarctic, at the first time I went there with the British expeditions, most of the areas of that part of the Antarctic had already been mapped. I was the last one to go there where there was blank space. And the blank space that was left on the map was the peninsula, the central part, the plateau of the peninsula. The reason being that the ships had gone down the one side and the sledge dog teams had gone down the other side. And they had both made their maps pointing in towards the peninsula. But they couldn't see what was on top of the plateau. The plateau was like a no man's land, in a dead territory, empty. And the reason was that there was an escarpment, like a big rock face, about 3,000 feet high. And people could not get up to this, up to the top, onto the plateau, except on about three places on the entire peninsula. And so my job was to go onto the top and then right the way along the top and to make the map of that final area. So I was the last one to make a map of unknown territory in that part of the Antarctic. And then from that time on, this was 1958 on, when I came out in 58, the only maps that could be made from that time on were detailed maps, with theodolites doing triangulation, accurate maps. Mine was the last map to be made by the old-fashioned exploring methods, where you travel with a wheel on the back of the sledge, and you use a compass to take bearings. And it's called a sledge wheel and compass traverse. And this was the way we made the maps. From my time on, from 1958 on, there were no more maps like that. And so I wasn't interested in making the more accurate maps. So I didn't want to go back to that part of the Antarctic. So then I went to the other side of the Antarctic, to the New Zealand side, where I joined a New Zealand expedition. Because in that part of the Antarctic, in the Ross Dependency, there were still areas which were unmapped, totally unmapped, blank, white paper. And there I could still make maps of unexplored country.
You were not interested in Greenland anymore because it was not white anymore.
Because it had been finished, yeah. I was only interested in exploring. And equally, when I was in with the New Zealanders, I made the last map in that area. Because in 1962, when I finished, the Americans were then flying airplanes all over the Antarctic, taking photographs. They were also flying in with helicopters, with survey teams occupying stations on the high summits of the mountains and making maps, very precise maps, very accurate maps, using air photographs and ground control. And this was not for me. I wasn't interested in that. So all of my experience in the Antarctic, which is 5 years, was in the period at the time when you could still, for example, climb a mountain, and from the summit of the mountain, whatever you saw beyond that point was unexplored country. You were the first human being to see it. Equally, you could go along a coastline or down a glacier to the end of the glacier. You could look along the coast and you'd be the first human being to see that stretch of coastline. And this was the magic for me of the Antarctic. And in 1962, with their photographs, I was no longer interested, so I came out. Then I moved up to the Arctic, and I've been in the Arctic ever since. I switched from the Antarctic to the Arctic. And of course, in the Arctic, you couldn't make maps because all the maps have been made already. Like, for example, in Greenland and northern Canada, all of that territory had been mapped from air photographs or from the ground by surveys. And the only area that was blank was the middle of the Arctic Ocean, because there was nothing there to map. And the only thing that had not been done in the Arctic Ocean was a crossing of the Arctic Ocean from one side to the other. I mean, Admiral Peary, Dr. Cook and various others had claimed that they had reached the North Pole by going the shortest way to the pole and back. And so my plan was to make a journey from one side of the Arctic Ocean across the pole to the other side. And that was the first crossing of the Arctic Ocean. And that was a journey which took a year and a half, but that it was a different idea to the Antarctic, because I wasn't making a map. I was making a journey of exploration, a pioneering journey, in much the same way that, for instance, when Nansen drifted across the Arctic Ocean with the Fram, he had a scientific expedition which was based on the ship, and the ship was drifting. Now, what we did was we were a scientific expedition, but with no ship. We were moving with dogs. And then we set up our camp in the summer and also in the wintertime and drifted on the ice with the tents. But in that time, we were doing scientific work. So ocean depth soundings and geophysical work and studies of the ice and air sampling studies and all kinds of things.
It's interesting that you make such a difference between what you were doing there and what you were doing on the Antarctic before that, because you were mapping, but you were also sort of venturing into unidentified territory.
Mm. Well, both of them were a form of exploration. I mean, the one was a pure exploration in the sense of making a map of unknown territory. This is the the traditional way of describing the explorer. He's a man who goes into unexplored country and comes back with some information, usually in the form of a map. Now, from the time that you couldn't make maps because it had been done, or if you were going to go, for example, across the North Pole, where there's no map anyway, then what you do is you make a map of the seabed, or you make some other scientific work, which is also exploration, in much the way that Nansen did. And of course, Nansen was probably the greatest of all the Arctic explorers, because he was this perfect combination of being the scientist and the adventurer and the explorer. He was this combination. Now, the sad thing is the word explorer is totally misused these days. You know, every expedition is called an exploration. Every adventurer is called an explorer. And they haven't been exploring for 25 years. There's nothing to explore. They are adventurers. And that's all they do. They just simply adventure. They don't produce maps. They don't produce science. Or if they do any science, it's just a little tiny bit just to make it look as though they're useful. Really, the priority is to be the first to get to the North Pole on your hands, blindfolded, backwards or something. It becomes very contrived. Contrived means when you try to move the goalposts. You have a game and you no longer can be an explorer, so you shift the position of the goalposts. You say, well, look, the rules have changed now. Mm-hmm. That instead of going across and being the first man to cross, the first human being to do this, we will become the fastest human being to reach the North Pole. Unsupported, or the fastest to go by yourself, or whatever. You know, they keep on thinking up new ideas of getting to the North Pole, which is different to anybody else.
Far-fetched.
Yes. Yeah. It's in a way it's necessary because we're running out of things to do. But the sad thing is that the focus is always on the pole. They must go to the pole. And the sad thing is there are plenty of things to do in the polar regions. But the modern adventurer needs to have something which he can focus on, so something which the general public understands. And so they have to keep going back to the North Pole or the South Pole, which is very sad. It's a lot of wasted energy. They could use that same energy in going to some other part, which would be useful, but they perhaps wouldn't get so much glory. And this is really what they're after.
Yeah, it sort of taps in with the aim of the film that I'm working on,
yeah.
Because it is also about what people from different parts of history get out of it.
Yeah.
So it's also about first getting to the pole, and then you have to think up another goal.
Sure, that's exactly right.
We go from discovery to scientific work, and probably after that you go to something else.
Yeah, sure, sure.
But what's the goal that you think is valuable?
The goal, throughout my own career, the goal has changed. For instance, when I first started when I went to the Antarctic for the first time, when I was 20, and 1955, now, at that time, about 80% of the Antarctic was unexplored, totally, utterly unexplored. No human being had seen it. It was blank on the map. It was white. Now, within a very short time, that map was completed, because from 1955 to about 1960, there was much more activity, much more increase of interest in the Antarctic. The International Geophysical Year attracted a lot of attention to the Antarctic. And so on. So there's a huge input of energy went into the Antarctic. Also, a lot of the Antarctic was uninteresting anyway. It was just ice cap. So there was nothing much to make a map of. The only parts that were interesting were the rocks around the outside, the coastline, or some of the mountains, the mountain ranges. So within a very short period of time, the Antarctic was completely mapped, all of the interesting bits. So from my point of view, I then had to shift my attention to something else, because my goals had been achieved. My interest in the Antarctic was I couldn't justify going back there to make maps as other people had made before, but I was going to produce better maps. That wasn't my interest, because I was a pioneer, deep inside a pioneer that was looking for something which hadn't been done. And at that time, there were very few things that hadn't been done. The world was very quickly being finished, as the period of exploration was ending. And so by 1965, 66, the only thing that was left, really big thing, in the world, as far as I was concerned, was to make a first crossing of the North Pole, because the first crossing of the Antarctic had also been made in 1957. Mount Everest had been climbed. So the only thing that was left was the crossing of the Northern Ice Cap. And then you complete the trilogy. It's like three things: the highest mountain in the world, the Southern Ice Cap of the world, the Northern Ice Cap of the world. The other two had been done. I wanted then to make the final, the third. And having done that, then what next? Well, what next was to make a film. What next was to make a circumnavigation of Greenland. But all these things were, in a way, past the period where history was being made by the explorers. It was, in a way, I was now into extra time, when there was really nothing else to do except climb Mount Everest by a more difficult way, or backwards, or blindfolded. But I couldn't be a pioneer anymore. There was nothing else to be the pioneer of. And so at that stage, I began to wind down, so to speak.
Before you go, this, the idea of the trifold task of climbing the highest mountain, the Ascap, where does that come from?
It just comes from looking at the map of the world and saying, you know, what is man doing here? And looking back through history, through 400 years of history, and you can see that even in Frobisher's day, Martin Frobisher, he was claiming that the only thing that was left to do was to go through the Northwest Passage, to discover the Northwest Passage. The only thing left to do. That's what he actually said. And yet there was a North Pole to discover, the South Pole to discover, the Antarctic to discover. But as far as he was concerned, there was only one thing left, and that was the discovery of the Northwest Passage. So all the way through history, man has been looking for something which he believed to be the last great thing to do. You know? And it obviously reaches a point where there isn't anything else to do of a particular type, like the exploration of the world in the physical sense, of actually finding out what's there. And, for example, when I made the journey across the North Pole, it was impossible to make a landing with aeroplanes at any point along that journey to pull us out if anything went wrong. So it was the last journey to make, the last expedition to make a journey of that sort of length distance where you could not be pulled out. It was the last sort of, in a sense, pioneering journey, where when you made the first footstep, there was only one way to survive, and that was to get to the other side. You couldn't come back. You couldn't be picked up by an airplane. You had to go right the way across or not survive.
And that's what you were after.
That's what I wanted to do, yeah. Now, in a way, the interesting thing about this was that on the day that we actually sighted land at the end of the journey, and that was a year and a half after we'd set off from Alaska, on the very moment, the very GMT time and the date that we sighted land for the first time was precisely the moment that John Young took the photograph of the Earth from the moon, with the moon in the foreground and with the Earth rising up. The Earth rise, it's a very famous picture. And that was the first time that any human being had taken a photograph of that. And at the precise moment that he took that picture, we sighted land at the end of the journey across the pole. And that to me was very significant. In a way, it was a kind of statement that the terrestrial exploration of the Earth, all of the main things have now been done. And it happened to coincide with the Earth rising from behind the moon and man's first sight of that. It also made me realize, too, that when you see that picture of the Earth rising, this blue and white sort of brilliant planet in this black, black background with the moon in the foreground, you think this is a very special planet. This is a very special place. And here, at the precise moment he was doing that, we were sort of saying, look how clever we are. We've just crossed the Arctic Ocean. We're sticking a flag in. We're saying, look how brave and clever we are. And what we were doing was the last, in a way, gesture of sort of chauvinistic bullshit. That the chauvinistic bullshit, you know, the sticking the flags in saying, look how clever, we are Norwegian, we are this, we are that, we've done this, we've done that. And it's unnecessary. You know, how can you, from the moon, see the planet Earth and see men sticking flags into it and saying, look how clever we are. It's unnecessary. It's past, it's dated. It's a part of history which has ended. And it ended at that moment he took the photograph. Or it should have done. You see what I mean? It was no longer necessary for man, because we'd made the last journey across the pole anyway, to still stick flags in and say, look how clever we are. We should be looking at ourselves as the human race, not as this or that. Yeah. So we should have more concern for the planet. We should be looking at the planet as a very special place, instead of just going all over it and trying to get famous by beating everybody else and going to the pole quicker or blindfolded or backwards. Or what the hell? What does it matter?
Do you feel pity, or let's say, do you regret having this flag? Do you feel?
No, because it was part of history. The whole idea, the period that I came into history was in the sort of the final stages of the period of exploration, the very macho period of history, where man needed to actually conquer, to go out and cross the Antarctic or go to the pole or climb Mount Everest or all these things. He was still discovering the Earth. And it was very necessary for him to have that kind of aggressive energy, because that was what drove him to get to these places, because it was physically uncomfortable to go there and do these things. And what usually happens with any kind of exploration is that the hardest parts are always left to the last anyway. Always. Always. And so right at the end of this period of exploration, it required this huge amount of aggressive, arrogant energy for man to go and to achieve these things. So he had to stick flags in. He had to be patriotic. He had to be an asshole, basically, to do that. He had to have this aggressive energy. So, you know, publicly he also had to be a nice guy too. So he had to sort of, in a way, be a two-faced man. He had to be driven by this force that he wanted to beat everybody else, but he had to be polite and nice and poetic and so on. So in a way, towards the end of that period of history, it was producing men like Scott, who was a very fine writer, a very sensitive writer, who was appealing to people's sort of sensitivities as a poet. You had people like Shackleton, who was a very flamboyant figure, who wasn't just an aggressive macho kind of man. He was a very sensitive man too, a brilliant leader. And so my interest in history after the journey across the North Pole started then to focus on why it had produced certain men. For example, was there any single individual that came to the Earth that had all the virtues of the explorer, that was the perfect explorer, the archetypal explorer? And the answer is no, not a single one, not even Nansen. That if you look back through the whole period of the last, say, 100 years, you find there was a period where all of the great explorers that made their name in history, that went into history, were on the Earth at the same time, and most of them actually in the polar regions at the same time. Some as very young men, some as very old men. Like, for example, at the time that Nansen was still alive, Bird was making his expeditions. They were all here on Earth at the same time, and yet not one of those men had all of the virtues or the attributes of the explorer to do everything that was needed. So you had this sort of battle between Amundsen, Scott, and Shackleton, which was necessary because no one of those three men had everything that was necessary. But the three together, fighting each other, produced the results. And the result in that particular case was that the Antarctic became, the South Pole anyway, was wiped off, ticked off as being one of the goals of man. It released energy. Instead of men putting so much energy and effort into reaching this point on the surface of the Earth, which is nothing, because they all knew there was going to be nothing there, it took that energy and dispersed it. It meant that we didn't need to go to the South Pole anymore because Amundsen and Scott had got there, following Shackleton. They could now use that same energy and go and do other things which were more useful. It's a little bit like if you say all of the energy that went into trying to go through the Straits of Gibraltar out into the Atlantic. There was a blockage there because man was afraid to go into the Atlantic. And the pressure came on and on. The curiosity, what lies beyond? One man went through, and then suddenly they all went through, and the whole of the Atlantic and the rest of the world was opened up. But it needed that one man to go through first to lead them. So that one man is special as a historical figure, as almost as a man sent to Earth, almost with a mission. His job was to do that. And he then released the energy to go out. So all the way through history, you can find these moments in time when something very significant happened. And from that point on, history changes. It goes into another gear. And we've reached that stage now where the Earth has been explored physically on the surface. The exploration now must be into other things. We don't need now to actually map any part of the Earth because it can all be done by satellite. So we're now looking for other ways. You know, what does man do now? He looks for a third pole. The other two have been discovered. He looks for the third. And the third is the mystical pole, if you like. It's the pole which cannot be seen. It's the pole which man needs to try to reach, just as he tried to reach the other two, but he can't see it. It's something which is spiritual. It's something mystical. It's something which is far more powerful, far more important than the physical exploration of the Earth.
You said that a great part of the Antarctic is in fact uninteresting.
For me, the vast majority of the Antarctic is uninteresting because it's plateau. For example, I've done a lot of traveling on the Polar Plateau, about 900 miles altogether. I've had, because it's been so boring, because it's flat and the wind is blowing and it's a whiteout or whatever, it's boring, intensely, excruciatingly boring. And I've had out-of-body experiences in that situation many times, like hallucinations, where I've just been on skis in front of the dogs, trying to keep the dogs interested, because there's nothing for them to see, so I ski in front. But then I have nothing in front of me, so I get bored. And then my mind wanders, and it goes out of my body and goes up ahead of me and calls to me to come on because it is so bored. For me, the only interesting part of the Antarctic was making the maps of the mountains or of the coastlines or of the plateaus, or of the coastlines or of the features that you could see. The actual boring plateau part was no good. So for me, for example, crossing the Antarctic or crossing the Greenland ice cap, there's no way that I could ever have done that. In a way also, for me, it was, it would have been a waste of time because there were other things more interesting to do and more worthwhile doing. That if you go across a plateau, there's nothing to map. There are no contours, nothing to see. So at the time, I needed to find land to map or oceans to cross. I've never understood people that wanted to go across the Greenland ice cap, for instance, from east to west or west to east or north to south or to cross the Antarctic because it's so boring.
I feel a sort of contradiction, but I'm not sure. It sounds like mystical venture.
The idea of going across an empty space, you mean, is a mystical experience?
Yeah,
that could be so. I mean, Messner certainly said so, Reinhold Messner. I mean, having climbed all the mountains, the highest mountains in the world, he then crossed the Antarctic continent. And his experience there was a physical one, obviously, because it was a long, hard, boring journey. But it also had a mystical experience. It was a mystical experience for him because of the space. In a way, I never enjoyed that space, because partly because there were too many other things to do. If I'd come 10 years later and all of the mapping had been done, then perhaps I would have crossed the Antarctic or would have crossed the Greenland ice cap or something. It would have had a different appeal to me then, because it was an open space. But because there were too many other things to do at the time that I was around, I never had the need to do that. Thankfully. I had enough, in a way, mystical experiences of plateaus in the Antarctic in the 800 miles or so that I traveled in on the South Polar Ice Cap. But there I had the benefit of not going from A to B, but going around the edge of the plateau, climbing the mountains and looking down onto the mountain ranges and then making maps. So it wasn't, it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah. You did not, I mean, I've seen some of your paintings very shortly, but you did not paint whiteouts, for instance, or things like that.
No, I haven't.
You are very quite figurative.
Yes, that's right. It's the paintings themselves are going to change anyway. The paintings change just like everything else that changes. Like, for example, we've just been describing the kind of exploration that my goals have changed over my career, during the course of my career. Equally, the paintings are going to change, partly because I'd never painted until 3 years ago, and I found that I could paint, so I started painting. And then I found that I needed to have enough confidence in the technique of painting that I could then sit back and not think anymore and just paint what was coming from inside me. And that took 3 years to learn, because I had to teach myself. I didn't go to art school, I didn't have any training as a painter, so I had to teach myself. So by trial and error, I learned how to do it. And now I'm at a point where I can be free, and I think the paintings will change. And there may well be whiteouts, you know, there may well be mystical paintings. There will certainly not be as much detail in any of the work I do from here. They won't be like photographs anymore. They will be much more, have much more feeling, but they will have the confidence of being a draftsman. I know that I can do it. So with that sort of knowledge of self-confidence, of knowing how to paint, I can now be free to just paint whatever's happening and coming through. And this is, for me, the big adventure. And this, maybe it's an adventure which I needed to have all the other adventures out of the way first, because I couldn't be where I am now with this quest for the third pole, for example, without having been to the other two. I had to do the other two first.
Where do you go now? Because you travel every year to the Antarctic.
Yes, the trips are usually very short trips, and it's I go down to lecture on ships, on tourist ships, or I go, for example, if they need a guide somewhere in the Arctic. But I prefer the trips to be very short ones, because I need to paint, not to be in the Arctic. But it's good for me to get out and have some fresh air, and to reconnect with the polar regions, because all of my paintings will be polar. What I will be doing is using my life's experience of like 13 years in the polar regions, then and all of those experiences will then come through my work. And what I'm trying to say is, look, the polar regions are a very fragile part of the world, a very beautiful part of the world. And I can't express this in writing as well as I can with painting. I can reach more people with paintings. And I can reach them quicker and more effectively, because there is a subliminal message in the painting that for people that like my paintings, and there are many that won't like them, but for those that like the paintings, they will sort of feel something which is being said to them through the painting. Whereas if I was to write a book, then it's in hard words. They have to read 200,000 words and they can't remember the beginning They sometimes can't even remember the name of the writer. You know, they lose their place when they're in a train. They shut the book. When they open it, they can't remember where they left. With a painting, you can look at it, and in seconds, you can get the feeling of what the painter's trying to say. And it may be not exactly what he's saying. It may be what the viewer is reading for himself in the painting. So I just simply stay open and receive what has to come, and I paint it. And hopefully the message is right, and it will reach the public to say that the polar regions are a very fragile part of the world, that we can screw it up very easily.
When you were on the expeditions, on several expeditions you were, so you traveled a lot for a time, what kind of communication did you have with the outside world?
In the first time to the Antarctic, we had radios from the base camp, which could contact Port Stanley in the Falkland Islands. And we'd do this also because we needed to send weather reports and so on. But the messages were always very, very, very short. We couldn't send personal messages, except extremely short ones, because it was all Morse code. That was the first 3 years. Then at Scott Base, it was much more sophisticated. And we had radios in the field when we were making the journeys with dogs, where we could contact each other and contact the base camp. For example, when I was with the British expedition, we had a radio set which in theory could contact the base, but we weren't in contact at all. From the time we left the base to the end of the journey along the plateau, we had no contact by radio. And the idea was that we would make a one-way journey along the plateau, the peninsula, and another expedition would come up and find a way onto the top of the peninsula, wait for us and show us the way down. Now, they had a radio, we had a radio, but we had no contact with each other. It was impossible. The radios were not good enough in 1955. And so we had to make a one-way journey, hoping that we would meet them and hoping that they had found a way up. If they hadn't found a way up, then we'd have to go all the way back, eating the dogs, because we had not enough food. At the day we actually met those men, we had 3 days' food left, just enough to get us down to the coast. And then we had to kill seals and birds and penguins to live for about 2 months until the ship picked us up. Now, that was in 55, 58. By 1960, 62, it was much more sophisticated. And of course, these days, you know, you can have satellite navigation, which tells you where you are. You don't even need to navigate. You can go across the North Pole or across the South Pole without even knowing how to navigate, because you just push the right buttons and your little magic box tells the satellite where you are. And the satellite tells NASA, and NASA sends a radio message and you know where you are. The amazing thing is these days you can actually be an adventurer, or they call themselves explorers, who goes across the North Pole or to the North Pole or the South Pole without knowing how to navigate. So things have changed very much.
Yeah. Virtual reality.
Yeah.
Do you regret it?
Sorry?
Do you regret it?
No, because it was all a part of history, and history is moving all the time. So in a sense that I came right at the end of a period of the old-fashioned explorers, where you used paper and pencil to navigate and where you had no contact from the time you set off to the time you got back. There is then a period, even though, as I said, when we completed that journey, it coincided with the picture from the moon. Nevertheless, nothing ever ends abruptly, exactly at a precise moment. You can say that was a significant moment in history. But there's a period of overlap. It takes a long time for man to change from being a macho explorer to being a sensitive explorer who's interested in other aspects of discovery. The discovery of the mind, for instance, what the mind is capable of, and what man should be doing on the planet. So there will be a period, maybe for another 10, 15, 20 years, where there will still be macho heroes going to the North Pole, going to the South Pole, sticking flags in, saying, look how clever I am, and so on. Before man finally realizes that there are other things he can do, which are just as exciting and as important to the evolution of man, but they are not as physical as macho, you know. You can still, for example, play a game of rugby or some or be a brilliant skier or a mountaineer. You can still express your masculinity, your skill, in that sense. But you must also have this other dimension, this other sort of driving force. It mustn't be simply to be better than everybody else as a physical specimen. That there are things that are more important to the survival of man than one's ego and sticking a flag in something.
Do you think this discovery of the mind, as you call it, has any geographical location? I mean, do you have to go there for this thing to the pole or to the polar regions?
No.
What do you think of birds who went to sit there on the plateau like a hermit?
Yeah, it's not, obviously it's not necessary or not essential for a man to go to those to put himself in isolation in order to have that experience. Obviously he can do it by closing his eyes. He doesn't have to physically go to the North Pole to have that experience. And there are many people that have been to the North Pole or the South Pole or whatever, summit of Mount Everest, without having those experiences. So it doesn't mean that every man that is a top mountaineer is going to be a mystic. I mean, even Messner is not a mystic.
Yeah.
He speaks like a mystic. He behaves like a mystic, but he isn't a mystic.
Oh, yes, he's a Zen garden.
Yes, he's a very, very professional and very sort of brilliant mountaineer. Nevertheless, I think that you cannot be so close to mountains, or so close, in my case, say, to the polar regions, without absorbing some of that mysticism. Now, perhaps I'm 10 years older than Messner, so it's interesting to see that 10 years ago I would have expressed myself in a very different way. For example, 10 years ago I would not have said that there was any mystical element in the experiences I had in the polar regions, that it was simply that any success that I had there was the success of knowing what to do through experience, that I'd been there so long that I understood and was in tune with the environment because of experience. 10 years later, then I would say, yes, well, I was actually picking up all sorts of things, lessons from the Arctic, which I wasn't aware of because I didn't have a name for it. I couldn't express myself. Equally, Messner is in that situation right now, being 10 years younger. That he is, all of the feelings are there. I can see, I can read him. I know that he is experiencing and drawing from his experiences. But he's not acknowledging at the moment that he is having mystical experiences, that he is deeply in tune with a level of the mind which he's not even aware of it right now, because he doesn't have the words for it.
He does write in his book a little about it.
Yes, he does. Yeah, this is what I find is so interesting, that he, of course, he's been sort of perhaps in some ways more exposed to it than I was, because he's been in Tibet or in Nepal, whereas in my case in the Arctic they have a different way of expressing it. I mean, in the Buddhist tradition, he's picked up some of that. His house, his castle in northern Italy is full of Buddhist artifacts, whereas in the Arctic it's a much more simple shamanistic belief, and so, you know, I wasn't exposed to that as much as Messner. So to some extent he's picked up some of the words and some of the ideas, the concepts, but he doesn't entirely accept them at this stage. They're absorbed into him, and they will eventually blossom and express themselves, I think.
Yeah.
Given
that's to give a special status to the Antarctic region, there being no any people around at all, nothing to pick up.
That's right. Yeah, this in many ways is one of the reasons why I preferred the Arctic to the Antarctic. The Antarctic for me was very exciting because I was a young man and because I was exploring, making maps, and it was exciting and very heady. It made me feel proud of myself and very special. And it was a very special privilege to be there at that time. But then, having moved away from the Antarctic and gone up to the Arctic, I found that, for example, having believed that I was very expert dog driver because I'd spent 5 years in the Antarctic, I then went to live with the Eskimos and found that I was not an expert dog driver. It was a very humbling experience to find that that the Eskimo boys of 9 and 10 were much better dog drivers than I was. And then I would argue, oh yes, but they're only good at driving on smooth sea ice. Yeah. They don't have any experience of glaciers or crevasses or things like that. And this was just my defense of my experience, my sort of need to be, my arrogance, because I discovered later that in fact they had a vast amount of experience, that some of the hardest journeys I've ever made in my life have been with Eskimos. That they would travel in conditions that no white man in his right mind would travel in, and they would do it with great expertise. So I learned to, in a way, start all over again in the Arctic, and just being with the Eskimos and finding out how they lived and traveled and hunted and what they felt about the polar regions was fascinating. But I'm not an anthropologist. I just simply loved being with them and traveling with them.
But opposed to the Antarctic, you prefer the Arctic because there is...
I preferred the Arctic partly because there were people and history, that the history went back much further than the Antarctic history. That all of the Antarctic history is a history of macho explorers, man breasting the cold winds, sticking flags in, being heroes and so on. Whereas the Arctic is a history which is entirely different. It's a history of people who are living there by great skill, by being in tune with the environment. They're not fighting the environment like the polar explorers. They have knowledge, understanding of the weather and of the ice. They are experts in living in that environment. Most of the heroics in the Antarctic were the result of inexperience, of amateurishness, where men with no experience in the Antarctic, simply with the conviction that they must be okay because they're Royal Navy, could go to the South Pole, you know? And that kind of arrogance is absurd when you compare it with the Eskimos, who are so brilliant at traveling in that environment and being in that environment. And they're in tune with it, whereas most of the white explorers were fighting it all the time. If there was a blizzard, then it was heroic to go out into the blizzard, whereas the Eskimo might just say, stupid, plain stupid. But he would still go into the blizzard if he had to, and he would perform in the blizzard infinitely better than the white explorer, because he was in tune with it all the way through. He understood. To live in the Arctic, you suddenly realize that there's so much more going on than just the snow ice caps and the sort of, you know, icebergs and the scenery. I mean, there's plenty of pretty scenery in the Arctic as well. The other thing about the Arctic is that the Eskimos travel in the winter and hunt in the winter, whereas in the Antarctic, all these explorers, for the vast majority, hide away in the wintertime because it's dark outside. So they hide in their little holes in the ground or in the snow and wait until the weather's better. Even if they have to go out and do an observation of the weather, the chances are that they will do it by electronic devices which tell them what the temperature is. They don't actually have to physically go outside. When I was in the Antarctic with at Scott Base, we had temperatures of -76 Fahrenheit, and two of us had to go out every day to look after the dogs because the dogs were outside on the shelf ice, on the sea ice. So every day we would go outside for 2 hours, whatever the weather and temperature. The rest of the men on the base only went outside once a week when it was their turn to fetch snow to put into the snow melter. That's the only time they would ever go outside. And so in the Arctic, the hunters go out in the dead of winter when it's pitch dark. They travel in darkness. They learn to move along the coastline by, for example, looking at the stars. And the stars will stop where they go behind a mountain. So if you know the mountains well enough because you've been observant, in the summertime, you know the shapes of the mountains. You can tell where you are, not by the stars, but by looking where the stars are not. In other words, if there's a mountain blocking the stars, you can see the shape of the mountain simply by that kind of blocking out of the stars. And they can tell just by that. They bob their heads up and down, and they can see the profiles of the mountains. I mean, they are the most amazing, brilliant travellers. This is simply because they know every inch of their territory. They're always observing. They can tell just by looking at the sea ice how thick it is. Eskimos never fall through thin sea ice. It's only white explorers that fall through thin sea ice. The Eskimo can tell just by looking at it if it's thin, whether it will take his weight. But the macho hero adventurer who is trying to reach the North Pole faster than any other white man has ever done, he will fall through the sea ice because he doesn't know the difference. He hasn't enough experience or enough interest in that sea ice. He's there really just to get to the pole and back again as quick as he can and get himself famous, make lots of money, get lots of fame, hear the sound of the applause. And when you hear the sound of the applause, then what happens is that you need to have more. It's like being a junkie. Like you get on a fix, on a high. Yeah, you hear the sound of the applause, you love it, you start to believe your own PR, your own publicity, and then the publicity dies away because you're no longer famous. Someone else has done something else and it's attracted attention. You're no longer famous, so you then have to do something else which is more famous than the other guy in order to hear the sound of the applause again.
And were you at the time also touched by this virus?
Yes, an explorer. Yes, absolutely. And it was essential at the time to have that kind of arrogance and that need for fame, because otherwise it wouldn't have done it. The risks, the dedication, the effort, the discomfort, all of these things were factors that would stop you from doing it. You needed to have that need, that driving need to do something very special, unusual. The arrogance to believe that you were the only man in the world that could do it. The absolute conviction that you would succeed. Total conviction. I think probably looking back through my life, at the age of about 33, at the time of crossing the North Pole, I was probably more focused on what I needed to do in life and had more energy focused in on that one objective than at any other time in my life. There was more power went into that. That was part of the reason for the success. There were also many other factors, but that was one of the reasons for that we were successful.
Sort of so personal Straits of Gibraltar.
So yeah.
Do you think is there a way in which people can live in tune with the environment on Antarctica?
I think it's very difficult because they don't have enough experience. They simply don't have enough time to be in tune. You can be in tune in theory, obviously. I mean, if you, for example, you have deep sort of convictions that man must conserve the planet, and so therefore you're careful about rubbish and that kind of thing. That's only just scratching the surface. You know, you need to be spiritually in tune, not simply in a practical way. And the man isn't really spending enough time there to have that kind of spiritual connection with the place. Whereas in the Arctic, I mean, the Eskimos would have that. And maybe a few white men too that have spent a long time there. We have to watch the clock because of the train. There's a train at 12:35 and there's another one at 2 o'clock.
Okay.
But also I had to pick my wife up at 12:45. I'm just wondering if there's anything else that I can give you, for example, one of those books, A World of Men, which talks about the Antarctic. It's all about the Antarctic. About my first expedition there and also my second one with the New Zealanders. And it also has that map in the back. It's not a well-written book, It was my first ever book, and it was very kind of naive and not well written, but it gives you the information. And then also you have some of this stuff here which give a bit of background too, at least some of the dates.